My name's Charlie Hill. I'm an alcoholic. Y'all look pretty good. I always get really nervous when I do this, and I don't salivate. It takes me a while to get going. And I thought it would go away. My sweetheart told me once to get rid of my nervousness, like 10 years ago. She said, just imagine everybody's naked. And, yeah, I know. It's just a... So I just really, it doesn't help anything at all. I try not to look at the front row, and I'd appreciate it if you didn't get up and get coffee, really. All I got is my story, that's it, my story. And I'm a garden variety drunk. I'm just another passenger on the bus. It's funny, it comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought I had plenty of story, and then we'd hear all these really great speakers and all these really frightening things, and I tell you how sick I am. I thought, man, I wish I'd have done some of that stuff. That's ridiculous, you know. I was born in Compton, California. Yeah. And I kind of went downhill from there. Then we moved to here, to Las Vegas, really. That's pretty much how it started. But all my whole family, they were all blue-collar workers. They were longshoremen and truck drivers and worked, putting windows in and things like that. And all my heroes drank a lot. So everybody I knew that had what a man was, they all drank a lot. And while I was growing up, though, some things happened to me that, no reason to share. But let's just say it wasn't an Ozzie and Harriet upbringing. And most of it was alcohol related, and I swore that I would never be anything like that, like my dad and my uncles, and that I would never drink like that and never yell at a wife like that, and I would have the kind of a household where somebody could invite their friends to come over. I don't know if that affects anybody here, but I didn't have the kind of a household where my friends would say, come over and spend the night. That just didn't happen. That wasn't one of our deals. Because I never knew what it was going to be like. It could be either everything was great and everything was fun, or it was the fights and the cops would show up. So, but that's not why I became an alcoholic. I didn't fit in. I never did really fit in. I just didn't feel right. Didn't seem to measure up to the way you looked, and I had all these turmoils. I was a fat kid with pimples and couldn't talk to girls. And somewhere around junior high school, I at a dance, somebody had a bottle of Hill & Hill whiskey, and we went out in the parking lot and drank it. And my whole life changed. The zits fell off, and I could talk to women, and bullies didn't scare me. And I just, all of a sudden, it was like a bridge between the way I was and the rest of the world. All of a sudden, I could look people dead in the eye, and I could talk to them, and it made life very manageable, which was kind of a curse. I'm still not salivating. It's really cute. I live in Cabo San Lucas, Mexico. You feel my pain. So I wanted to get some water, and they wanted to make sure to get me bottled water. I mean, I live in Mexico. Anyway. Growing up like that, and all of a sudden alcohol worked, and all of a sudden I didn't want to be anything like my dad, but I had a curse there. Alcohol did exactly for me what I needed. So I just started drinking like a fish. My sister's here tonight. She introduced me to alcohol, actually. So it's her fault. And we had a really a great system. My dad was in the last stages of his alcoholism when I was in like 11, 12, 13 years old. And he would hide his whiskey all over the house. And my mom was an Al-Anon. So we would steal the booze. We would steal it if we could find it. We stole it. And there was nothing he could do. Right? He couldn't go to our Al-Anon mom and say, the kids are stealing the booze, I'm hiding. So. And then my grandfather was a longshoreman, retired longshoreman, and he had whiskey that was filtered through a mountain of charcoal. I still don't know the name of it. I'm sure it was good stuff. It was filtered through a mountain of charcoal. But he would buy it in quarts, and he was kind of senile. He would forget he had them, and we would steal those and drink those. And so I pretty much stayed hammered through high school. I got a junior pregnant when I was a senior, and back then you got married when that happened, so we did. And a year later, I got divorced and went back to high school. So, but it was Rancho High School, so it wasn't a big deal. While I was gone that year, they invented marijuana. So, this was 1967. I swear they invented it that year. And the first time that I smoked it, I thought, here's something that works almost like alcohol. And it was something my dad didn't do. Now, I'm sorry I smoked that marijuana. I never knew it was going to be a controversy. I never knew I was going to wind up here, but I did. So I really I just didn't want to be an alcoholic. I wanted to be something better than an alcoholic. So I always made sure that I drank like a fish, but I always took pills with my alcohol and mellowed it out. I was a puker. Glad to know my sponsor was a puker. I puked in my pants once. Yeah, it's funny now, but I was sitting on the toilet. Anyway, jeez. Well, that right there should have qualified me for this room. But it didn't. I had a long way to go. I can just kind of fast forward that whole part of my life. You know, I got married a second time and went in the Army, went to Germany, came back, broke in as a dice dealer at the Union Plaza. And didn't make a lot of money when you're breaking in, but I spent it all staying hammered. And then after 5 years in the business, I was on wife number three, and I was working at the Aladdin Hotel when they had their grand opening, and I made a lot of money, and I stayed hammered to the exact dollar amount. Whatever I made, and then a little bit more. I never had any money when I worked at the Union Plaza. I never had any money when I worked at the Aladdin. The only thing changed is that I owed more money when I was at the Aladdin Hotel. It didn't matter how much money you gave me, you could not get me even. I always drank right up to what I made, and then some. So I was a total paranoid when it came time to... I'm amazed I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just amazed that I got here. For one thing, I wasn't an alcoholic. I caught that in here. I came here for all the wrong reasons. I was a total paranoid at the end of my drinking, and I lived in an apartment complex at a whole bunch of apartments, an A.G. Spanos deal, and I had the apartment on the second floor right above the guard shack, so that when people would come in, their headlights, as they came in, would go across my living room wall. And I kept the lights out all the time. And then I would stand up and I'd back up and I'd part the curtains to see who it was that was driving in. I didn't know anybody there, but I knew what everybody drove. I was just so, I had a peephole in the door, and that peephole was to see who I wasn't going to let in. I couldn't stand silence. If it was silent, I would start listening to conversations of people walking by and freeze in my tracks and listen to what was being said. And sometimes there were no conversations out there, but I didn't know that till later. I had to have a little bit of noise on. I had the TV on just a little bit all the time. But it couldn't be on too loud, because if it was on too loud and you knocked on the door, then you would know I was home. and I couldn't have that either. I was pretty crazy. The people that I was afraid of were people that I loved. I was a weekend dad by this time, and I was afraid when the phone would ring, which would terrify me every time it rang. I was just terrified because it might be my kids or my folks or somebody, you know, that I would have to talk to, and I just couldn't do it. But then I wanted to answer the phone because it might be so-and-so. And it just, the phone would ring a half a dozen times during the day, and I'd just exhaust myself trying to figure out what to do. They didn't have caller ID back then. So my life is so much simpler now. My thinking was a little bit messed up. I was a dice dealer, so it was perfect for that. I was a has-been and a will-be. I've never really met a dice dealer. I never have. I've met a lot of people that deal dice, but never one that's really a dice dealer. I used to be something else, and I'm going to be something else. That was like my dice dealing days. I deal dice, but I used to be this, and I'm going to be that. I never was what I was. Never. Never. I had a house that I bought here in Las Vegas, and had just enough money to buy the house, and I buy this house, and I'm going to fix it up. I had a calico cat at the time, a long-haired Persian calico cat, a beautiful, beautiful animal. Unfortunately, it had diarrhea, very bad diarrhea. It just crapped everywhere, and so I was trying to figure out how to tell my daughter at the time that it was time to take this cat to Meowschwitz, you know, that this cat had to go. And while I was trying to figure out how to say that to her in a more gentle way, the cat got pregnant. So with my keen alcoholic mind, I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll wait till the cat has the babies. And then I'll take the pick of the litter and then, you know, do whatever with the rest of them. It was a good idea, but unfortunately it was a genetic disorder. And all the kittens had the same problem. And so anyway, back to this house. I had this one room in the house, and I was going to make it. I was going to make this room into something really cool. And I was over here. I was going to have a built-in bar, and I was going to have the mini blinds. That was popular back then. Maybe a skylight, big shag carpet, stereo. And so I painted the walls white. And that was as far as I got. And since I was going to change the carpet anyway, that's where I put the cats. And the cats crapped everywhere. But I would bring people over. When they would come over, they'd say, how you doing? I'd say, well, fine. Hey, I got to show you this room. Right? Oh, over here, I'm going to have a wet bar, a skylight, and then there's going to be mini blinds. And check, it's going to be really cool. In my mind, that's what I was showing them. What I was showing them was a freshly painted room covered in cat shit. So, and my thinking was just a little bit off. This is back in the disco era, and we went to somebody's house before going out, and it was just a nice, nice lady. She was a very nice lady, and hi, how are you? And I'm just normal, and I have a drink, and I had to use her bathroom. So I went and used her bathroom, and even, you know, I always have this urge to check people's medicine chests. I still have that urge. I changed in somebody's house tonight, and I wanted to check the medicine chest. It's terrible. But I checked the medicine chest because sometimes there's drugs in there that are expired, and those are dangerous. So, and they had, sure enough, there was some expired Percodan, so I ate them, you know. And then I go back, and I'm talking to this lady. Hi, how are you? And I had to go back to use the bathroom because I had to vomit. So I was back in her bathroom now, and I'm throwing up. And I'm holding on to the toilet like just, you know. And I'm looking around. I notice there are these rust stains, these really unsightly rust stains. And I remember thinking to myself, what a pig this woman was. So anyway. I just don't know how I got here. I know that I used to call Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to call them, but I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work because my dad came here and he died drunk. But I had to do something because I was just so crazy. I was just so nuts when I got here. So I started calling Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would say something like, you know, I got a friend who has a problem with alcohol, and, you know, what do you think he ought to do? And they would, I think I got the same lady every night, and she would say, why don't you bring your friend to a meeting, and there's one tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. And then she would say, she said, don't drink till tomorrow night at 8. And I couldn't do it. I could not go from one night to the next without drinking. Couldn't do it. And so in a moment of clarity, after a few days, I asked her if there were any earlier meetings. And there was a noon meeting over at the Showboat Hotel across, you know, the Denny's across from Showboat. So that's what I did. I got all dressed up and got into my brand new car. I had to get in the passenger side, you know, because the other side was caved in. I'd wrecked it in a blackout. And I went down to the Denny's to join Alcoholics Anonymous just to get the heat off. I was just so crazy. I just didn't know what else to do. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they had, at this meeting, they used to order lunch. And I remember I ordered a tuna salad sandwich on whole wheat toast. And I remember that so specifically. And then they started to introduce themselves. They went around the room. I'm so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic. I'm so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic. And it got to me, and I said, I'm Charlie, and I'm an alcoholic. Well, I just started crying. All of a sudden, it felt, in that brief instant, that it was going to be okay. And it had been a long time since it felt like it was going to be okay. But just when I said that, I felt like it was going to be okay. And I just start sobbing, and these big, ugly, racking sobs. I cried through the whole meeting. I don't remember a whole lot of what was said. But I remember after the meeting, a couple of people came up and said, you're new, aren't you? You know. And they kind of tucked me in. I just launched myself into Alcoholics Anonymous. I attacked it like I attacked alcohol. I loved everything about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous when I first got here. I joined the group between the acts or between the shows over at Duffy's, and it was just great. It was a lot of people from the casinos and a lot of young people and musicians, and we all kind of hung out together. We kind of roam around in a pack and stayed sober together. I would go to a meeting in the morning, and a meeting at noon, and a meeting in the afternoon, and a meeting at 6, and a meeting at 8, and then a meeting at 10, and drink about 3 pots of coffee. And then I would go home to my wife, who was still stoned. She thought I was just out of my mind, because I'd go home and just vibrate, you know. I wanted something, and I assumed that it was in here, because I hadn't seen it anywhere else. I wanted to fit in. So immediately I bought a big book. I didn't read it, but I bought it. The steps were a snap for me. I just looked at the steps and I said, well, okay, I can't drink and my life's a mess and I know I'm crazy and I'll turn it over to God. I'll turn it over to you if you want it, you know. I just take it. And I didn't have to do step 4 because I wasn't doing step 5 under no kind of circumstances. So 6 and 7 were pretty easy. So I got to step 8. You know, this is like I'm in the program a week or so. And step 8 made a list of all those we'd harmed. And okay, well, that's, I didn't have to do that. Because they were mailing me stuff. You know, I had a whole stack of envelopes at home with the little windows in them. So I already had a ready-made list. My 8th step was done. So I just launched right into 9. So I went over to my ex-wife's house. I knew who I owed the biggest amend to. It's my ex-wife, and I'd left her very badly and did some real bad things. And she had some kids, and so I went over to her house, and I made this pitch to her, knocked on the door, and she kind of nervously opened the door, and I said, you know, I just need to talk to you for a minute. And what is it? So we sat down, and I said, you know, I owe you support. I haven't paid any child support, and I'm really sorry for everything I've done to you, and here's $500, and I gave her $500 in cash. And she said, okay. And she took it back and put it somewhere. And at that moment, I just felt like the spirit of Bill Wilson was just soaring through me. It was a wonderful feeling. And then I'm getting ready to leave. And just before my hand hit the doorknob, I said, could I have a receipt? And she said, well, I don't know how to write the receipt, so can I talk to my lawyer first? And I snapped. I never hit women. I got to tell you, I never did. But all of a sudden, I had this woman that by the throat, and I was dragging her to the fireplace. She was ruining, for one thing, one of the most spiritual moments of my life. But my daughter walked in. My daughter was about yay high. And as soon as I saw her looking at me with that look of terror in her eyes, I let go. And I got out of there. So I went to a phone and I called my sponsor. And he said, you know, what are you doing on step 9? You know, they're numbered for guys like you. Let's get back to 1. So, because of that action, I didn't get to. I saw my daughter about 6 times in the next 8 years because of that act. So went back to step 1. I did this program the best that I could. And I had Dick for a sponsor, you know. Did the best I could. I did my 5th step on my way out of town. I was moving. They said, don't make any big decisions or choices or changes in your first year. And I listened to it. I had selective hearing. They also said, don't have any relations. But I looked at those guys that weren't having any relations, and I didn't do that one. But no big changes in your first year. So I left my wife and I moved in with a lady of the evening. And then I decided to move to Central Idaho and become an underground miner. So, and I really fit the bill for an underground miner. I was a floor man by that time on the casinos. And I went over to Dick's and did my 5th step. He was totally bored, really irritated me. And my car was already packed. I had a white-on-white Lincoln, and off I go to Idaho. And I didn't have a mining outfit. You know, I had all these suits. I didn't have a mining outfit. So I went to Target, or Kmart, Target, I think, and got a mining outfit. I had Mork and Mindy suspenders. And, you know, I had no concept of what miners wore. It looked a little strange when I got there. The first thing I did, and then I went to a town called Cary, Idaho, which is a very, very small town, very little, tiny town. So I go, bless you. I go to Cary, Idaho, and I'm staying in this motel that has no floor, no subfloor, and there's cats under there, wild cats. And I got a contact out of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was right next door. And I thought, well, this is good, you know. So here I am in a white-on-white Lincoln. And I go next door, this little house, and I knock on the door, and this biker answers the door. Well, he doesn't really answer the door. He kind of opens it like this. He's got his hand behind his back. And he goes, yeah. And I go, I'm Charlie Hill, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, I don't know what to say. He says, yeah. I go, well, you know, I got your number and your name from central office. And they said you were a member, and I wondered if we could talk. So I go in, and I sit down. And he kept his hand behind his back. He had a gun. The reason he had a gun was he had gotten into some trouble with somebody from Las Vegas. And I showed up in a white-on-white Lincoln in my Mork and Mindy mining outfit. And he thought I was there to kill him. This is my contact, you know. We had a rugged relationship. So I decided I'd go to a meeting. It was kind of a long ways to a meeting. There was Twin Falls, which was quite a ways away. It was Ketchum, Idaho. Sun Valley. I drove to first meeting I went to was in the Sun Valley area, and I looked all over and I finally found this meeting. There's one guy there. His name was Dave. And when I got there, he was the only guy there. So I went in and I said, you know, Charlie Hill, I'm an alcoholic. He said, great. So, you know, I told a little bit of my story, and I got to the part where I smoked that pot in high school, and he just stops me right there and he goes, we don't talk about that in here. And I'm looking around, and there's only 2 of us there. Well, the best part of that story is that he started another meeting. So. Oh, my Lord. I was a joy to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 32 years old. By that time, I started to put some money together. Flew around in an airplane, and I had a Cadillac. I bought this Cadillac and had it restored. You had to look at it twice to see it. It was a 73 Eldorado convertible, emerald green, you know, with a 501 engine in it. I really looked like mafioso or something. And a white Corvette and a Bronco. I just had all these toys, and I would fly to meetings and make sure that people knew that I flew to meetings. So I was only sober like, you know, 3 years. And just drive the old-timers nuts. I would tell the newcomers, if you want what I have, which, of course, who wouldn't? You know, I have all this stuff. Just do what I did, you know. So God, in all his infinite sense of humor, took all the money away and sent me packing. I went broke, really broke. All I had is I had enough credit to get a tank of gas, which doesn't get you far in a 73 Eldorado convertible. I had just enough money to get to Jackpot, Nevada. Yeah, all the hot spots. And I got there, and I didn't have any more gas. I was trying to get to Reno, but I didn't have enough gas. So I go there, and I went into a casino, and they said, "Hi, I'm Charlie Hill." Didn't say I was an alcoholic, of course. And I was a dice dealer for 8 or 10 years on the Strip, and I really'd like to have a job. This guy looks at me like I'm from Mars. Like, what am I doing in Jackpot? And he says, "Well, yeah, let me call your references, and you come back Monday." And he starts to leave. And I grabbed his arm. I said, "You can't leave. I don't have enough gas to get out of here. You know, I really need to go to work." So he called up some references. That's pretty good references. And came back and said, "Okay, I know that you're just trying to get enough money to get out of here to a real town. So here's the deal. You come to work for me and work the whole season, and then we'll call it good." So I went to work as a dice dealer. I'm newlywed again. This is wife number 4. Which is a story in itself. Just a wonderful, wonderful girl. Every woman I married was really great. They were just really nice girls. That wasn't the problem, evidently. This girl, I asked her to marry me because I'd just gone broke. And she liked me when I didn't have any money, or had a bunch of money. So when I lost my money, I wouldn't ask her if she would marry me, because it made me feel good instantly, and she said yes. So I'm a newlywed, she's living in Idaho, I'm working in Jackpot. They have no housing in Jackpot, so they have this company housing. And the way company housing works is you work, and then you stay in these apartments, and then they take it out of your paycheck. And they didn't have any available, so he said, "Look, we'll find you somebody." So anyway, halfway through the shift, he brings over this guy named John. And John was a big guy, walked with a stiff foot. And that was who I roomed with. So I go to his apartment, and his apartment had no shades. Every bulb was bare. He had one knife, one fork, one spoon, one pan, one glass, one plate, one cup. Like being in prison. And a bed, and then he had a sofa in the living room and a big book on the counter. So I thought it was really a coincidence, really an amazing coincidence. And he was in Alcoholics Anonymous for 11 years. And he had this great, great look in his eye. The look in his eye was just such calm. So I thought, well, this guy's got no problems. So I spent 3 days telling him all my problems with being rich and going broke and everything. And then finally I gave him a chance to get a word in edgewise, and he told me his story, which was that he was a drywaller and he fell out of a skylight and broke his foot so bad that his shin stuck in the floor. And they took him to Boise and decided that they'd have to cut the foot off. So a doctor comes in and says, "That's the worst foot I ever saw. I want to save it." So they start fixing it, and they would fix it and then break it and fix it and break it, and it re-heal, and he spends 6 months in there. And then after 6 months, his employer says, "You were trespassing. I didn't want you working there," so he yanks all of his medical insurance. Meanwhile, his wife runs off with a drywaller with 2 good feet. He's telling me this, and he's still got that same look in his eye, like he's got no problems. And he says, so I go to Twin Falls, and they teach me how to fix pinball machines. And I come down here, and they hire me as a 21 dealer. And I'm thinking, you know, you just don't have a grasp, guy. Don't you realize how messed up your life is? And his life wasn't messed up. What he told me was that Alcoholics Anonymous did not solve the problems of his life, but it taught him to live very comfortably with unresolved problems. And I'd heard that before, but I'd never seen it before. I'd never seen anybody tell me that I don't have a problem right now, right this second, and mean it and be living it. He said, if my hair's not on fire, I don't have a problem. I don't have a problem right this nanosecond. He says, you probably never will. Moved to Reno. I did the whole season, got out of there, went to Reno. By then, the Cadillac was history. When I got to Reno, I had a borrowed car, a 1962 Mercury. And so I went to get a police or a sheriff's license, you know, the sheriff's card, so I can go to work in the casino. And when I went there, they asked me my address, and I didn't have an address. I was living in my car. So I wrote down 1962 Mercury in my address. And the lady, she goes, is that in Reno or Sparks? And I said, well, it's in the parking lot, you know, like that. And she says, well, that'll never work. So she wrote down the address for the Peppermill Hotel, and that was my first address there. And I was so happy because I got to go to work there. And got a sponsor there. I was getting to come up on 5 years sober, and I was crazy again. Because what happened was that what happened with me was I was lying in my relationships. I lied in my relationships, and a lot. I never gave a woman an even break, never. I would sell them a bill of goods, they would take me home, and then I would try to live up to it as long as I could. That was my ill-conceived coping skill for relationships. And my fourth wife was like all the rest, she was just perfect. But I had six relationships going on, and I was married to a perfectly wonderful girl. And I would go to meetings, and people would say, how you doing? I'd say, I'm fine, you know, because I couldn't tell them. And then it got so bad, I was lying in meetings. I couldn't tell the truth in a meeting. And so I started trying to find people that would listen to me. But I would always look for the ones who were kind of intrigued by the fact that I was having six relationships and wanted to know the details, didn't really want to help me much. And so a guy met me, more or less, a guy named Dave Hamza, and I was selling RVs at the time. And he sees me from across the room. He knew how I was. He heard my name. But he walks up to me, had a baseball hat like that, and he gets right up to my face where the brim was touching my head. It's the first time I ever met the guy. And he looks at me, and he's smiling like this, and he goes, will a real Charlie Hill please come out? So I pushed him, you know. Unfortunately, he was a boxer. He was a heavyweight boxer. He fought Ezra Charles, who was the heavyweight champion of the world at the time, and went the distance with the guy. So we had a real short argument. And the next day, though, I looked for this guy. I wanted to find this guy because I couldn't figure out how he knew, because I looked so good on the outside. How do you know how much pain I was in? So I went and I talked to him, Ask me the two questions. Are you willing to go to any lengths to beat alcohol? Can you follow some simple directions? And I said yes to both of those. And he said, well, let's talk about what's going on. And I told him about these relationships that I was having. And this is just my story. This is not something I would recommend for everybody. But what he told me to do was tell him the truth. What a mean guy. So I was going to do that. I was going to tell him all the truth. That's what I was going to do. So he said, well, what are you going to do? I'll say, well, I'll go to this one, and I'll say, look, I met this girl, and she's a lot like you, and I don't know how it happened, you know. But he said, what are you talking about? I said, well, I couldn't do it. I could not even tell him the truth about what was really going on. He said, why don't we write it down? So we worked on some rough drafts and finally came up with this one. I'm sleeping with other women. Sometimes the same day that I'm with you, I've been lying to you. And he said, oh, that looks pretty good. Take that out and read it to him. So I did. And at the end of the day, all my relationship problems were gone. I was so tired at the end of the day, the last person that I went to, I just knocked on the door and she answered, and I said, here, and I just gave her that piece of paper, and I laid down on the floor. I couldn't even read it to her. And she reads it, and I'm still with that woman. This is, I've been with her for 22 years. And I don't lie to her either. That is amazing. You can clap for that. Jeez, you know. Man. How did I even get to that point? I've been with the same woman in a monogamous relationship for 22 years. It just stuns me. A lot of things came out of that whole thing. I talked about the relationship. Some people say, what does that do with staying sober? Well, I could not drink, but I'd like to not drink and feel comfortable in my skin. And when I found out that in all the other areas of my life, I could get away with lying a little bit here and there, and nothing too bad would happen. But just for me, for this guy in relationships, I got it right back the same day. And talk about telling the truth, you know, so, and doing the steps, and working this program. And I came up with some pretty creative ways to work this program. So if I'm going to tell him the truth, here's what I can do. I can cheat on her, and then when she asked me what I did today, I could just tell her. Come on, it's the 10th step, right? When I'm wrong, promptly admit it. That's not the right way, because what that is that's maintaining my sobriety at the expense of another human being and going through that pain that I would go through. There was this other way I never even considered. Not cheat on her. And then when she asked what I did, I could just tell her the truth. It was so much easier. Like it freed up a whole chunk of my brain that I could use to form corporations that eventually went broke. Just, it was so easy just to tell the truth. I didn't know how to do it. I did not know how to do it. Little chunks of that stuff, learning how to say no. Somebody would say something like, I'm going to move a heavy safe up 5 flights of stairs next Thursday. Would you like to help? And I would say, oh, yeah. And then as soon as I hang up, I'm trying to figure out a way to get out of this. Because I don't want to do it. You owe me some money. When can you pay me? Next Thursday. I couldn't pay you next Thursday. Just that whole truth concept is was very uncomfortable for me. Once I got a handle on it, then I kind of went crazy with it. You know, I would, when you didn't even ask me, I would say things that were true about you that you probably didn't need to know. So then I kind of reeled it back a little bit. If I had any kind of message, you know, for Alcoholics Anonymous, I can tell you I dearly, dearly, dearly love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's given me my entire life. I live in Cabo San Lucas, Mexico. You know what a far cry that is from Cary, Idaho? Or that apartment that I couldn't even look out the window of? I live in paradise. I work half days. We have 3 days of rain a year. That's kind of cool. But I go to a meeting every day. I have my. What happened for me is that what I hear around here is that a phrase called I live in AA and I go to the world. See, I used to live in the world and I would go to AA. So I would live in the world and tough it out, and then I would go to AA and kind of check in. And I've switched that completely around now and have for some time. I live in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my home. This is my home. And I go out to the world and I do my stuff. And then I come back here. This is my home, Alcoholics Anonymous. The whole thing about God. I had a big problem with that God thing. But I heard here in Las Vegas, I heard somebody say they would rather live their life as if there was a God and find out at the end of their life that there wasn't one than live their life like there wasn't a God and find out at the end of their life that there was one. And for a dice dealer, that makes perfect sense. That was like I didn't need any more qualification. So I began to live my life as if there was a God. I live my life as if there is a God. And my life is perfect as long as I do that. It's just perfect. You could put a gun to my head and ask me if I believe there's a God. I couldn't tell you. But I can tell you this. I live my life like there is one, and my life is perfect. It's just perfect. Dave Hamsa taught me quite a bit, and he took me through the steps. And one of the things he did was he wanted me to start sponsoring people right away. Is that for me? He told me after I got through done telling the truth to everybody, I'd ruining my relationships. He told me that he wanted me to start sponsoring people right away. And I said, okay, what do I do? He says, well, you can't sponsor anybody who's here now because they already know you. So your best bet is to sponsor people that are coming in the door. So he gave me this pitch. And the pitch went, I would catch their names and say, hi, Chris, I'm glad you're here, and I hope to see you at another meeting. Or, hi, Dave, I'm glad you're here, and I hope to see you at another meeting. And that was it. And then see how it worked. And what I found was that at meetings, a lot of times right after the meeting, you know, everybody, I just want to get up and talk to people I know. But that the newcomer and the visitor would kind of be sometimes left behind. And but then here comes somebody out of the crowd and remember their name and say, hi, Bob, I'm glad you're here and I hope to see you at another meeting. And the next meeting, that person would look for me. Not because I had anything special, because I remembered their name. And they would look for me. And then after a couple of times like that, if they wanted to talk, I'd start introducing them to other people, maybe go to coffee, and then eventually they'd say, you know, I need some help. And I started sponsoring new guys, and I started sponsoring a lot of new guys. He told me that the way to stay sober was to stay close to your sponsor, go to a lot of meetings, and sponsor a lot of newcomers. And so I did that as much as I could. This is in Reno, and moved to California, and Sedona, Arizona. I didn't do any geographic stuff until I got sober. So I sponsored a lot of guys and stayed close to my sponsor and sponsored newcomers. And then Dave moved to a town that he didn't like the meetings, which I can fully understand. Because every time I move, the first thing is I don't like the meetings, because they always do it wrong. I go to Idaho, and somebody goes, I'm Bob, I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Bob! And I'm the only guy that said, hi, Bob. You know, I'm the only guy in the room. They don't do it right. They don't clap at the right time. They don't say the prayers the right way. And then after I'm there for a while, that's the right way to do it. And then the next place I go is wrong. So I fully understand that. I went to a meeting. We moved to a place that had the Alcoholics Anonymous worst AA, so I won't give you the name of the town. But I can tell you when I got there, I went to a meeting and I said, I'm new here in town and I'd like to get some phone numbers, maybe make some contacts. So I sent a schedule around with a pen and it came back blank. I'm tapping this girl next to me. Look at this, you know. Next day, my lovely bride goes to the same meeting. You know, I'm new in town. I'd like to get some phone numbers, passed around a schedule. Came back loaded. All guy numbers. So I called them all. So I've been in some towns where, you know, it isn't quite as stellar as it is here in Vegas. So, but he moved to a town he didn't like the meeting, so he quit going. And he got in a beef with his sponsor, which isn't hard to do because I know his sponsor. And all of a sudden he wasn't sponsoring any newcomers because everybody he sponsored had 10 or 20 years. And the only time he ever went to a meeting was if he spoke. And he lasted for 2 years. And then 5 days before his 26th birthday, in a moment of insanity, he picked up a drink. And he stayed drunk for the next 9 years going to meetings and drank his brain away. So with any luck, tomorrow I'll be able to go see him. He's at the nursing home in Boulder City for the veterans. And we had the same conversation over and over and over. So he told me exactly how to stay sober, and then he went out and proved it. So I really took heart to that. And I really believe the way to stay sober is stay close to your sponsor, even... Well, anyway, stay close to your sponsor and sponsor newcomers and go to a lot of meetings. And I do that. It's not too tough a deal to stay sober. So. While we were doing the birthday thing tonight, I went broke. I go broke a lot. I get rich and go broke and I'm trying to stop that. But I went broke in Florida. Ran out of money. Didn't know what to do. Decided to be a waiter, so I waited tables for a while. This is very recent, just a couple years ago. And they kept offering me a drink. Every night they would offer all the waiters a drink. I didn't like that. I noticed that the bartender, nobody ever offered him a drink. So I went to bartending school and attended bar. It was kind of a spectator sport, you know, when you're like 22, 23 years sober and you get to attend bar. And one of the thoughts that hit me was I always wanted to do a chip system in the bar. You know, like somebody, you're new here? Oh, yeah. Well, here's a chip, a little starter packet for you. The guy at the end of the bar there has got 35 years of being drunk every day. And, oh, how'd you do that? Well, I just drank one day at a time, you know. A little birthday cake, you know. Oh, God. I'd like to invite everybody to come down to Cabo San Lucas. We have a meeting every day. It's a wonderful, wonderful spot. You have to worry about which group to go to because there's only one group. My home group is Grupo Hacienda in Cabo San Lucas. Meets every night at 6 and has a bunch of other meetings scattered in there. So if anybody's going to come to Cabo San Lucas, it's only a couple hours away, please get a hold of Bob or something, get my number, hook you right up. Alcoholics Anonymous does not need me. In fact, the first time I spoke, I was so proud of speaking. And afterwards, they had tapes at the back. This is in Lake Tahoe. And I go to this table where they got the tapes, and there's a whole crowd of guys coming up. And I'm looking at the tape guy, and I go, doing a pretty brisk business, huh? He said, they're getting their court papers signed. So anyway, speakers are a dime a dozen. Good coffee makers are hard to find, though. But thank you, thank you, thank you for my life.